These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Conquest of the Americas, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Marshall C. Aiken. Dr. Aiken is currently an associate professor of history and chair of the history department at Vanderbilt University. He completed his undergraduate work at the University of Costa Rica and at the University of Kansas, where he also earned his master's degree. He received his Ph.D. from UCLA in 1981. After teaching for 2 years at Loyola Marymount University, Professor Aiken moved to Vanderbilt University, where he has taught since 1983. He has won numerous teaching awards at Vanderbilt, including the Jeffrey Nordhaus Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching, the Madison Surratt Prize for Excellence in Teaching, and the Chair of Teaching Excellence, awarded by the university's Board of Trust. In 1999, he was named the Carnegie Foundation Case Tennessee Professor of the Year. Dr. Aiken has published numerous articles in scholarly journals and popular publications, and is the author of 3 books, including Brazil, The Once and Future Country. Professor Aiken prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Three Peoples Collide.
Welcome to the Conquest of the Americas. I'm Marshall Aiken, a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. Over the next 12 hours and 24 short lectures, I'll present you with an array of ideas and issues that cover the span of the history of all of the Americas between roughly 1500 and 1700. I have 3 main objectives in this first lecture. First is to present to you an overview or a plan of the lectures in this course, give you something of a sense of what I'm trying to do over the next 12 hours, in a sense, sort of what is the method to my madness in here. The second is to present to you what I mean by conquest of the Americas and why I think this is so important. The principal objective, though, in this first lecture is to give an idea of what are the main themes that I'm going to cover in the next 12 hours. Now, discussion of the conquest and colonization of the Americas is shaped by the methods and the approach of the historian, and so I want to say something a little bit about what my approach is and what my perspective entails. History, at a minimum, has 2 meanings. It is the events which took place in the past and our recounting or retelling of those events. Those events are long gone. We can't have access to them anymore except through these accounts and this retelling. And by its very definition, all of those accounts come from a particular perspective, a bias, or a point of view. There is no neutrality in history. So I want to say something about my perspective and my point of view. I believe it is important to be upfront, balanced, and fair. Objectivity is not possible in history, but balance and fairness is. So I'm going to say a little something about how I approach the conquest of the Americas, because this is a topic which is especially laden with controversy and bitter discussion, especially over the last decade or so. We can see this by looking at the celebration of the Columbian Quincentennial, the condemnation of the Columbian Quincentennial in October of 1992. This is a big contrast with what took place a century before. In 1892, Columbus was celebrated, glorified as the great founder of the Americas. There was a whole exposition in Chicago to celebrate this over a whole year of different sorts of expositions, different sorts of glorifications. Columbus was the great hero of American history. But 100 years later, in October of 1992, it's a different setting. There are protests all across the Americas, in Canada, the United States, Latin America, from areas dispersed as far apart as Brazil, Peru, and Guatemala. What we see are protests by Native American peoples condemning Columbus, vilifying Columbus as the invader, the destroyer of Americas and the Native peoples of the Americas. Columbus is portrayed as someone who is a villain, who is at the cutting edge of the destruction of Native American peoples. Kirkpatrick Sale's book, The Conquest of Paradise, conveys this idea of Columbus at the cutting edge of European civilization as the destroyers of the civilizations of the Americas. Rigoberta Menchú, the Guatemalan Maya activist, is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in large part because of her work to produce solidarity among the peoples of the Americas, and as part of the solidarity to condemn the European invasion of the Americas. So here then is my perspective on the conquest of the Americas. To speak of conquest invokes European invasion and domination of other peoples. And that's what it was. There's no other way around that. Otherwise, we're soft-pedaling the story. I prefer to see the history of the Americas, of all of the Americas, from Canada to Argentina, as a process of collisions of three peoples: Native Americans, Europeans, and Africans. During the Columbian Quincentennial, many scholars looked for another way to describe what I call the Columbian moment, this moment of first encounter in October of 1492. They turned to a more neutral theme, more neutral word of encounters. I personally find this word inadequate to describe the bitter struggles that went on in this process of collision and conquest. The bland neutrality of the word encounters does not begin to convey the power and the impact of these bitter struggles that took place across the Americas. What I also want to say is this course combines what I would call two perspectives, history from above and history from below. I will focus on what is often seen as very traditional and outmoded, which is the story of heroic, and in some cases, villainous individuals. I firmly believe that we have to focus on these important and central figures because of the important role that they play in making history. This is not to glorify or to sanitize these individuals, but to present them because they are so central to the story. Rarely in history are humans simply good or bad. At the same time, this course consciously combines the story of elites with the struggles of common peoples. The great majority of those people who made this history, and the great majority who are lost to us through the historical records. Although the elites play a powerful, in fact, the most powerful role in shaping and creating history, including up to the present, this struggle is a two-way process. It's a two-way street. This is something which is an unequal process, in which the elites are obviously more powerful and have a greater hand in this, but it is a two-way process. The elites have the upper hand, but they do not have a free hand in creating history. History is forged by both elites and non-elites, but the problem we face as historians is that the elites leave the records. They leave the accounts. And therefore, what we end up with is obviously a biased and unbalanced account. So the good historian attempts to use those accounts and those records, knowing that they're produced by elites, in an effort to get beyond those sources and to see what happens to the non-elites. This course then combines a history of prominent individuals, people like Columbus and Cortez, with a discussion of key institutions, institutions like the Catholic Church. And it looks at the larger structures that have shaped the history of the Americas, structures, by this I mean the economy, politics, social organization. History then, from my perspective, arises out of the combination of individual actions and these larger structures. These long-term structural forces and important individuals as well as the common people. Even the most spectacular of individuals, let's say a Winston Churchill, does not have a free hand. He has to deal with the hand that's dealt to him. He inherits the Second World War. This is something which had been building and taking place before he becomes Prime Minister of Britain. And so in this sense, despite the tremendous influence of Winston Churchill, he is operating within an environment that he did not create. In my view, history is summed up in this classic phrase, the man and the hour meet. Or to put it in the words of probably one of the most influential philosophers and social thinkers of the last two centuries, Karl Marx, men make their own history, but not in conditions of their own making. But enough philosophizing and background on my approach to history, let's turn to an overview of what I'll be talking about over the next 12 hours. Now, although everything in Western civilization tends to be split up into three parts, this course is split up into six. And so I have sort of double triad, I suppose. As I will say repeatedly in these lectures, the Americas are created out of the collision of three peoples: the Native Americans who were here, the Europeans who invaded, and the Africans who were brought forcibly across the Atlantic in the slave trade. The next two lectures, the first section of the series, focus upon the native peoples of the Americas. And in particular, I'll give a brief overview of all of these peoples, but then I'll focus in on what I call the high civilizations, the Aztecs, the Maya, and the Incas. I'll do this very quickly to give a sort of sense of who the peoples are that are in the Americas before Columbus arrives, before the Europeans conquer. The following lecture then turns to the other side of the Atlantic, to the so-called Old World. By this I mean Europe, Africa, and Asia. And we'll look at the peoples of the Old World, especially the interactions of Europeans and Africans, and in particular, in those two centuries before European overseas expansion. I want to emphasize again that the Old World exists for centuries, for thousands of years, in contact with each other, even if only indirectly. Africans and the Europeans and the Asians had had contact with each other, even if indirectly, through trade and through conquest. They'd been in contact with each other, in fact, since the rise of the human species hundreds of thousands of years ago, as it emerged out of Africa and spreads across the rest of the world. But they have not been in contact with the peoples of the Americas for thousands of years. In these two centuries before European overseas expansion, I'll focus in this lecture on how the Europeans and the Africans interact, and in particular, how the Europeans begin to move down the coast of Africa in the 15th century. Now, in the next series of lectures, really a series of seven, that look at European overseas expansion and the process of conquest and its origins in the Americas. I'll focus primarily on the Spanish and to a lesser extent on the Portuguese because they are really the center of the story in the 16th century. Now, European overseas expansion, although it begins in the 15th century in a serious way and expands across the Atlantic in the 16th century, the Europeans have been moving out into the Atlantic for centuries before this. Already in the 10th century, the Vikings have moved into Iceland, Greenland, eventually into the coast of what today is Canada. This has been taking place for a long time, but what I'm going to talk about in this section is really the European expansion that begins in the 14th century out into the islands of the Atlantic and south along the coast of Africa and eventually west across the Atlantic. And interestingly enough, it's the Portuguese, tiny little Portugal, that's at the forefront of this process. The Portuguese, who we tend to forget these days, a country which had perhaps 1 million to 1.25 million people in the late 15th century, are the first and the pioneers in this process of moving out into the Atlantic and eventually across the globe. And as we'll see, it's because the Portuguese are the first to put together those key factors which are necessary for overseas expansion: technology, politics, culture, and economic incentive. And this will then lead us into the story of Christopher Columbus. And I'll focus an entire lecture on what I call the Columbian moment, October 1492. I will argue this moment in October 1492 is not only one of the most important moments in European history or the history of the Americas, but is arguably the most important moment in the history of the world in the last 1,000 years. And there's a big claim. The most important moment in the history of the world in the last 1,000 years. And so that entire lecture will focus on Columbus, what I call the Columbian moment. The following five lectures in the series focus on the process of conquest and expansion into the Americas. I'll begin with the conquest of the Caribbean, what I call the process of stepping stones, as the Spanish work their way through the islands of the Caribbean. And by 1519, Cortes will then move off of Cuba west into Mexico and begin the conquest of the Aztecs in central Mexico. I'll focus on the conquest of Peru and Pizarro. And then in the final lecture in this series, I'll look at the process of expansion out of Mexico and Peru into what I call the frontier regions. Primarily, I'll look at Central America and the movement into North America. And this, these are probably the most dramatic moments in the series. The conquest of Mexico, you can hardly do better than that for drama. Here you have Cortes leading at the beginning 500 Spaniards. They land on the coast of Mexico, and within 2 years have conquered an empire of somewhere from 10 to 20 million people. 500 to 1,000 Spaniards conquering an empire of 10 to 20 million people. And so we'll focus on Cortes and his role in this process, and in particular, what it is that leads the Spanish to conquer an empire that is so large when their numbers are so small. And then we'll also look at Francisco Pizarro and the conquest of Peru and what is yet another dramatic story, in this case of less than 200 Spaniards landing on the coast of Peru in the early 1530s, capturing Atahualpa, the Inca emperor, and then marching into Cusco, into the mountains of the Andes, toppling the Inca Empire, and eventually controlling within a few years an empire that stretches from what is modern-day Ecuador into northern Argentina and northern Chile. These two episodes, the conquest of Mexico and the conquest of Peru, are perhaps the most dramatic events of this whole process of the conquest of the Americas. In the next section, I have a series of four lectures. These four lectures, in fact, look at the process of colonization and the implantation of colonial society. What I attempt to do here is look at primarily Spanish America and Portuguese America in the 16th century. Lecture 12 turns to my favorite topic, Brazil, because my training is in Latin American history, and particularly in the history of Brazil. And we'll look at the construction in the late 16th century of Portuguese society in the tropics, in particular the implantation of colonial society built around the great plantation complex. It's really in the 1560s and 1570s that the Portuguese on the northeastern coast of Brazil create what will become arguably the most burdensome colonial legacy in the Americas, the large landed estate. In this process, in the late 1500s, roughly from about 1560 on, what we see is the creation of a large estate growing cash crops, sugar, later tobacco, later in the 19th century, coffee. And these cash crops are produced by slave labor imported from Africa. And so what you see created here really is the first great example of plantation society in the Americas. African slave labor, cash crops for export, controlled by a small white European elite. This occurs first in Brazil in the late 16th century, and in the 17th and 18th centuries, this will be adopted and adapted in the Caribbean and what today is the U.S. South. Lecture 13 then moves to a related topic. It moves to the transatlantic slave trade and what is the largest forced migration in human history. 12 to 15 million Africans forcibly brought across the Atlantic to work as slaves in the Americas. Let me emphasize that once again. The largest forced migration in human history. Not until the Second World War, when tens of millions of people are displaced by warfare in Europe, is anything comparable to this. What this involves is over three centuries, the forced migration of millions of peoples from Africa in the so-called Middle Passage to the Americas. We'll look at the origins of the transatlantic slave trade in the 15th century, then its importance for the Americas over some 300 years from roughly the mid-16th century to the mid-19th century. And in particular, in three regions, what today is the U.S. South, the Caribbean, and Brazil, Africans quite literally built these new societies. Lecture 14 then provides an overview of the importance of land and the great estates across all of the Americas. On these estates, especially in Brazil, the Caribbean, in the U.S. South, unfree labor produces the wealth. In large numbers, Indians and Africans are the working people in the labor force. In the case of Brazil and the Caribbean and the U.S. South, these are African slaves who are producing the wealth. In the great estates of Mexico, Central America, and the Andes, it is unfree labor, Indian labor, that is producing this wealth. They are not slaves, but they're not free. And so what you have is some form of either coerced labor, draft labor among Indians in the Andes and in Mesoamerica, or African slave labor in the U.S. South, the Caribbean, and Brazil. But in all three cases, what you see taking shape is large numbers of non-European peoples producing the wealth controlled by a small white European elite who own the land. The final lecture in this section then turns to the importance of silver mining and the fleet system in Spanish America. As you will see in this lecture, the land produces wealth in the forms of crops, but also in the form of precious metals. Colonial America is built on three main pillars. The land produces crops that feed people and that are exported to Europe. It produces silver, which in fact is the engine of economic growth. And the third pillar is the commercial system, which connects all of these peoples together and in fact moves that silver across the Atlantic and goods around the system. It's ironic that the so-called Golden Age of Spain, which is roughly from 1550 to about 1650, is actually an age built on silver. It's the silver mines of Mexico and of Peru in the 16th and 17th centuries that provide the great wealth for Spanish imperial expansion. Now, the fourth section, of course, turns then to pause from the military conquest and colonization to look at what historians have called the spiritual conquest. Lecture 16 looks at the sword and the cross and how they go hand in hand, how the church and the state are a single process in conquest and colonization. And I'll emphasize here that the military conquest, in the end, is completed. In fact, it's not completed in most of the Americas until the end of the 19th century. Until the Great Plains Indians are conquered in the late 19th century, to the Yucatecan Maya are conquered at the end of the 19th century. But the military conquest is completed in the Americas. The spiritual conquest was not completed and never will be. We'll look at the nature of the spiritual conquest. In particular, we'll look at conquest and conversion, especially in Latin America, by looking at those priests, how they attempt to learn the native languages, how they attempt to persuade and force native peoples and Africans to convert to Christianity. We'll look at, in particular, the orders, the religious orders, the Jesuits and the Franciscans, as excellent examples of this process of conversion and conquest. The next lecture then turns to what takes place out of this conquest and conversion. In the effort to impose Christianity, Catholicism, on non-European peoples, on the Africans, the Indians, and their descendants, they resist. They bring with them their own pre-Columbian beliefs. The Africans bring across the Atlantic with them their own cultural traditions and religious beliefs. And they resist this process of Christianization and conversion. And the end result of this is the creation of new religions that I'll focus on in this lecture, religions which are not African, not Native American, and not European. And in particular, I'll focus on two examples of this. I'll focus on Candomblé, which is an Afro-Brazilian religion, which is largely concentrated on the northeastern coast of Brazil around Bahia. And then I'll focus on folk Catholicism, which is a sort of mixture of pre-Columbian Indian beliefs with Catholicism, which produces this sort of religion of the peoples, which anthropologists call folk Catholicism. The fifth section of the course then brings in the other European conquerors. In the 17th century in particular, lectures 18 and 19 focus on the arrival in particular of the French and the Dutch and English in the 17th century. And we'll look at how they differ from the Portuguese and the Spanish in their process of conquest and colonization. In a sense, what happens at the end of the 16th and beginning of the 17th century is the end of what I call the Iberian monopoly of the Americas. The Spanish and the Portuguese pretty much have it to themselves for much the first century of conquest and colonization. And I'll compare the differing approaches of the English, in particular the French and the Spanish, in this process of conquest and colonization. I want to emphasize how they see the land differently, how they see the native peoples differently than the Spanish and the Portuguese. Lecture 20, then, brings in the French, mainly in North America. And we'll look at this process of how the French come into Quebec, what today is Quebec and Canada, and then gradually move down into the Great Lakes and eventually down the entire Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. And what the French will create in North America is a sort of enormous swath of land, of traders, of fur trappers that goes from Quebec down to Louisiana. And again, I'll build on this comparison with the other European conquerors. The final lecture in the sequence turns into the Caribbean, especially in the 17th century. And it looks at all the major European colonial powers, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the English, the French, the Dutch. This is the era in which the conquest of the Caribbean takes place for a second time. And at times, what you have is the conquest of other European powers by Europeans. This is the great age of the Pirates of the Caribbean. So when you go to Disneyland and Disney World, yo-ho, yo-ho, and all that. The Pirates of the Caribbean emerge out of this period of clash between the major European powers in the late 16th century and especially in the 17th century. Now, the final sequence of lectures comes back to the what I call the big picture. In lectures 22 and 23, there'll be a sort of synthesis of social and cultural patterns, of traditions. And in particular, I want to emphasize, I will look at both elite culture and the culture of the common people. We'll look at social patterns, especially we'll look at the issue of race and the racial diversity and the new religions, the new cultures, the new traditions that come out of this mixture of three peoples in the Americas. And I'll emphasize how this process of conquest was a powerful, ongoing struggle among Native Americans, Africans, and Europeans that produces new societies and new peoples that are not European, not Native American, and not African. They're truly American cultures. In lecture 23, I'll emphasize this by bringing these three peoples together. I like to see Latin American history, and in fact, the history of the Americas, with this sort of image. It's three rivers. Three rivers representing three peoples that come together. They collide in the 16th century at the moment of encounter and contact and conquest after 1492 and form this sort of churning, large river in which they intermingle and mix and conflict with each other. And then in the 16th and 17th centuries, gradually what begins to take place in different regions of the Americas is this river begins to divide and split into lots of small rivulets. And so that by the time you get to the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, you have lots of little rivers that have gone off in different directions, but they can all trace their origins back to this large churning river that's formed out of the collision of three peoples in the late 15th century. And I would emphasize that what we have here is both unity and diversity. I'll say this again and again over the next 12 hours. There is a unity and diversity here. We can talk of a history of the Americas because there are certain common patterns. There are certain common features. But at the same time, out of this unity and these common patterns, there is tremendous diversity. So that Argentina today is very different from Mexico, and Mexico is different from Canada, and Canada is very different from Brazil. But in fact, we can talk about a certain common history of the Americas. In the final lecture, we'll return to these themes that I began with today in this first lecture, in particular the convergence of these three peoples from the conquest of the Americas. And I'll conclude by emphasizing the larger comparative forces, the larger comparative patterns, as well as the differences. In the final analysis, these larger processes that begin 300 to 500 years ago leave both positive and negative consequences for all of the Americas. Let me pause for a moment to emphasize this point about unity and diversity with a personal story. In the early 70s, I was a student for about a year and a half at the University of Costa Rica. And in that year and a half, I met lots of students from all over Latin America. And I have wonderful memories of Costa Rica. One night in particular comes to mind when I think of this theme of unity and diversity. Sitting around a table with three friends that I'd met, discussing all sorts of things late into the night, into the early morning. And at some point, after a lot of very good, very smooth Nicaraguan rum, I came to the realization of what I would describe today of the unity and the diversity around us at that table. My friend Miguel from Chile, fair skin, clearly of Spanish descent. My friend Milton, born in Costa Rica, the child of Jamaican immigrants whose ancestors went back to Africa, traced their ancestry back for centuries to Africa. And then my friend Yvonne, the Nicaraguan, clearly a mestizo, this clear mixture in his face of Spaniard and Indian. And as we sat around that table, you could see the children of this collision of cultures. We all spoke the same language, Spanish. I with my gringo accent, Miguel with his Chilean Spanish, the fast, clipped accent of Nicaraguan, and what came to be for me standard Spanish, Costa Rican. But in the end, we were all very different, despite these similarities. The faces were different colors, the accents were different, we came from different cultural backgrounds, but they were emphatic that they were not just Costa Rican or Nicaraguan or Chilean, and I was not just from the United States, that we were all part of the same Americas. We all shared, and would eventually share even more, a common pattern of cultural traits in the Americas. Unity and diversity. We all came from a similar background, but from very different cultures and very different countries. There is a common history of the Americas, but there is also enormous diversity. So there you have it in a nutshell. The main themes and patterns that we'll see in the conquest of the Americas. This is material that I find provocative, stimulating, fascinating, and I hope you will too. I hope you'll enjoy learning about the history of the Americas as much as I enjoy teaching about it.